Welcome to this workshop on class beginnings. I'll begin the class with a bit of introduction. Some of you know me, some of you don't. I'm Verlin Garber from Hartsville, Alabama, and I've taught school for 8 years, not planning to teach this coming year. Actually, our family has plans to go to Greece for a month or two this fall as a trial basis for a longer term, so we'd appreciate your thoughts and prayers as we consider what the future might have for us there. The workshop today, let me introduce. We're going to be talking about how we can introduce our subject to the class in a way that gets their attention and helps them to be able to grasp what we're teaching. So I thought that I would model a history class. I love history. As an example of what a class opening can be like. And then I'll open it up to you. You can be free to criticize, discuss strengths and weaknesses of the demo. So our lesson today is on Philip. He was a guy who lived a long time ago, and he's been dead for, I don't know, over 1,000 years anyway. He was a king someplace off in Europe, not far from where Greece is today. You've heard the joke about if you're hungry in Hungary, then you buy a turkey in Turkey, and you fry it in Greece. Well, that's Greece. That's where this guy was from. Philip became king of Macedonia in 359 B.C., and decided to conquer the Greeks. So he fought battles with a bunch of them, but he left others alone. I'm not sure why. He gave his soldiers some really big spears that helped them win. And a few years later, he was killed, and his son, Alexander, took over. I need to go do something. It's going to take me just a few minutes. So I would like 7 volunteers to draw what these statements tell you. Joe, would you please do one of them? And Mike, I would just keep on 7 of you there.
Just pick one.
Just pick one. Draw what you think it's telling you. That way you're not bored while I'm gone. And if you would pass out these handouts, I would appreciate that.
This is my favorite way of teaching. Do we have artists? You draw for me, I'll tell you how to do it.
Nice to meet you. My name is Nikos, and I'm from Greece. Sorry, but my English is not the best. I grew up with my parents in the mountains of Greece. Very rocky there. My grandfather used to say that when the gods were creating the world, they would shake out the soil in the strainer and make this country, the Romans, they got all the good land. And when they were done, all they had left was a bunch of rocks. And they dumped them out, and that was Greece. And so we lived in the mountains of Greece, and we had a very difficult life. Very hard. By the way, thank you all for that. I'll use that later on. Poor farm was there. But one thing I loved to do as a boy, there were wild horses in our part of Greece, and I loved to watch them. And by the way, this is supposed to be an imitation of a Greek laborer's tunic. One day, we had a lot of excitement in our town. The royal herald came through, and King Philip was coming through from his capital city of Pella, And his son Alexander was with him. Now, Alexander was about my age. He was about 13 or 14. And he loved horses just like I did. Now, Alexander was a determined character. I found this out later when I got to know him better, that he he studied under Aristotle. And Aristotle taught him the legends of Hercules and Achilles and all those great mythological characters who could do anything. He thought he could too. And he saw these wild horses, and there was one young colt in particular that caught his attention, and he was determined to have that for himself. And so he asked me, since I knew the wild horses and their haunts, to help him capture the horse, and we did. And he tamed it by himself. He named it Bucephalus. You've probably seen pictures of Bucephalus. And then he asked me to leave my humdrum existence as a poor peasant farmer's boy and travel with him and be his groom, take care of Bucephalus. Well, that was the fulfillment of all my dreams. And this was the prince asking, so what could I say? Well, I said, nay. And then I said, let me go ask my dad. And my dad said, nay. What does nay mean in Greek? Yes? It means yes. We're terribly counterintuitive for us English speakers. Now, how much of that story is true and how much of it is embellishment, you've probably sort of guessed. There was an Alexander, born in Pella, the capital city of Macedonia, about 300 years before Jesus was born. Largely corresponding with the area of North Macedonia today. And Philip did conquer Greece, and he did have a son, Alexander, who did capture and tame a wild horse named Bucephalus. And he rode it everywhere. He was educated by Aristotle. By age 16, his father had appointed him temporary ruler. By 18, he was a general in his father's army, and at 20, he became king after his father was assassinated. Only 13 years later, he had conquered a vast area of Europe, the Middle East, and all the way to India. We know him as Alexander the Great. Now, we don't have the time for a real history class. If we did, we could discuss his military conquests. Did you know he named 400 cities Alexandria after himself? Made them models of Hellenic culture, which is why he's impacted us so strongly today. There's the legend that he sat down and cried when he reached the Indus River because there was no more land to conquer. We think maybe actually his soldiers refused to go further. And of course he died a tragic early death at 33 because of his wild living. Okay, now, your assignment here. To compare and contrast the two openings, I don't know how many of you were ready to walk out when I was talking about Philip. Thank you for hanging in there. What was wrong with that first opening about Philip? And did I maybe do some things better the second time around? In a bit, I'll give you a chance to critique the second one too, but let's contrast those first two. What were some mistakes made? And I made them intentionally. The subject wasn't boring. The style was.
The style was.
Right.
You started off with opening up, and you did not capture attention.
Right.
You said it in more of a long tone, didn't look at everyone like you should have. And then you pointed at a spot on the map and expected us to fill in details from our memory.
Right. Good.
It's very vague in general. You're saying, somewhere in Europe or a long time ago. Not really interesting.
Right.
You said I love history. What if I don't? It didn't like make me love it.
Right.
It was nice that you did, but it didn't help me at all.
There was nothing in it to actually grab you. It kind of that dry, dull manner again.
You like to do that a lot.
Right. I was so nervous doing this odd thing. No, actually, I did look at them a lot just to complete the poor effect. Did you notice the contradictory statements? Where was he from, Greece or Macedonia? Well, it is kind of a sticky issue, actually, because modern-day Macedonia doesn't exactly correspond with ancient Macedonia. And just to complicate it further, what's on here as the Federal Republic of Macedonia is now called North Macedonia because the Greeks don't like the idea of this country called Macedonia because the Macedonians are the big bad guys who conquered Greece back in the day. And there's actually a district of Greece known as Macedonia. So it can be really complicated unless you do your research. And of course, in the first one, I just interchanged the terms very randomly. Are jokes a good idea in catching interest? But what about lame ones that missed the point about Hungary and Greece and Turkey? That one had absolutely nothing to do with, yeah, maybe it got a laugh, but it was actually a distraction. The things we use should actually channel interest. Okay, so did I do some things better the second time through?
Definitely.
So
the dress, the attire proves your interest.
Right.
It's a valid way of getting attention.
Okay. Costumes are hugely helpful.
Told a story.
Character
you relate to, you know, you can imagine yourself being that character.
Mm-hmm. And I'll have a bit more on this a bit later, but you have to be careful with those stories that it's clear what's fact and what's fiction. You know, you don't want your students going home talking about Nikos the peasant. He wasn't the point. The point was Alexander. Nikos was the character by which I introduce you to Alexander. What about criticism? The only way you improve is through criticism. What could I have done better to capture your interest in that, or in that second opening?
I'll turn my back so you can do my three.
I thought of your pronunciation of Macedonia. This last year, I noticed that one of the new CLE textbooks pronounces it Macedonia.
Okay.
So that was a new one for me. Sometimes perhaps Macedonia is acceptable as well. But a correct pronunciation that's different than what we're used to hearing can also grab their attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As well. And maybe, and I didn't even know that, thanks for pointing it out, but probably if I would have known that and used that, I should probably have put in a little side note that this is the correct pronunciation, because if you would have used that and I'd have been in a class of yours, I'd have said, you mean he doesn't even know how to pronounce Macedonia? You know, those assumptions were way too quick to make. You know, so there is a sense where, now maybe as a teacher in front of your students, you have enough credibility that they'll believe you even if you pronounce words wrongly, but... Yeah, thank you.
So I like the accent and changing your voice and, you know, trying to speak like a foreigner. But I think you should have limited it to maybe two sentences or three, because I think that was part of what made it difficult for you. You weren't sure when to change, and we were you know,
right.
I'm just thinking from your student standpoint, and I've watched them watch me and it kind of wins for me when I'm teaching. They're like, is he going to be able to pull this off? Whatever I'm trying to do, you know. So maybe not take it so far, you know, practice
good.
Really well the two lines.
Mm-hmm.
Get them, and then okay, so now that's not me, and I can't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Thanks for that, because that is one thing that's actually been a fairly new thing I've tried to implement into my teaching just in the last year or so, largely through, I don't know if you're familiar with the Great Courses by the teaching company. There's a course on world history by Professor Linwood Thompson, and he teaches every class dressed up with an accent. This is actually where we got the pattern for this robe. And he teaches pretty much his whole class in his accent. I've always struggled with that. And so you're right, Joe. I was grappling with this. How do I deal with this? Finally, I said, scrap it. So, thank you.
But I think it was a great touch. Like, I think it's necessary to do, but I don't think I could handle doing it for long.
Yeah.
You know, in your
well, shape. I was. I obviously went longer than I should have.
Well, with that, every teacher is different. You can't do it. I can't come to this class and think, oh, yes, I'm going to do it this way when I get back to my classroom, because I'm not you. It's not going to work.
Thank you. And I've got a point on that. Okay, let's get into, I have an acrostic here, impactful. I'd like to look at ways we can create impactful opening. First of all, we need inspiration. Start with a bang. Don't start in a monotone, dry, dull. When you're at a place like WFTI and you enter a class taught by a teacher you've never seen before, he's got about 30 seconds to make a good impression on you. And I probably blew that big time. Yeah. Hopefully I turned that around a little bit. But what is it? It's a speaking style. That's what pulls you in from the first minute. Now, I have sat in some classes where that was somewhat lacking, but as I disciplined myself to sit there and pay attention, he had some depth and he had power in his content, and that drew me in. But I did kind of have to work for it. So use a forceful and excited delivery style. But at the same time, too much drama with a lack of content can really be a disappointment too. I've listened to some great speakers who, at the end of their workshop, I'm like, well, it was great, it was interesting, he told a lot of stories, but what can I really use in my classroom? So make sure there's content in there as well. True inspiration is much more than emotion. It comes from a thorough grasp of the subject. I find that once I understand something thoroughly, I get excited about it. Preparation is absolutely essential for inspired teaching. Expertise. You've probably heard the quote, know your stuff, know whom you're stuffing, then stuff them eloquently. I would venture to say that teacher enthusiasm is probably the number one factor in student interest and enthusiasm. Because from a student standpoint, is it really worth listening to if even the teacher can't be excited about it? The worst bankrupt in the world has lost his enthusiasm, and he will lose his students shortly if he hasn't already. Teachers complain about needing to compete with the action outside the classroom, you know, the loud trucks, the harvesting equipment, all that stuff going by. And it's great if your classroom can be set up in a way where you don't have to compete with it. But make your action so compelling that they don't even notice it. D.L. Moody said, before I get in the pulpit, I light myself on fire and the people come to watch me burn. True inspiration actually comes from God. The root of inspiration is spira re, which actually has the idea of God breathed. Which reminds me, yeah, I forgot this. On criticisms of the second introduction, I did something that was completely out of historical context on purpose. When I talked about the gods, I made the sign of the cross. Hundreds of years later. A Greek today would probably do that, but we're talking B.C., so what if I don't have that true inspiration? Well, there probably is a place for drumming up some fake excitement or inspiration, you know, just making yourself excited. But be careful. There's a barn shop where I work at some, right next to the Branding Iron Steakhouse. And there's nothing more frustrating than being there at 5 o'clock with a growling stomach and the smell of roasting meat coming out of their exhaust fans, blown by the wind straight across where I'm working. So if you're going to get your students tantalized, then give them a T-bone at the end of it. You know, be careful. It's not just a lot of froth. Now, what if this excitement and inspiration and charisma is not my personality? Well, be genuine. And those of you who would have known me back at the start of my teaching, you would have found me having much less enthusiasm and charisma. I would probably have stood up here about like this and just pretty much talked like this. I have grown into it, and I would like to think I've learned some lessons in it. But so be yourself. Don't try to be like other people, but be genuinely excited. We do have different ways of expressing, and your students will soon learn to know you well enough. They'll know when you're excited, even if you're not walking all over the place. But maybe you need to study more. Remember that inspiration often comes from a thorough grasp of your subject. I think I'm going to jump over this part for the sake of time. I'll read it if I have time at the end, but if I don't, buy the book, The Seven Laws of the Learner by Bruce Wilkinson, and read chapter 1 about how Howard Hendricks, teacher of Bruce Wilkinson, kept his students' attention. It's a great story, but it's one you can read on your own. The Seven Laws of the Learner by Bruce Wilkinson. Second point, mimic. I thought you just said to be genuine. Yes, I did. Let me explain. Find a teacher whose teaching style you admire and work elements of that into your own class presentations. be yourself, but learn from him or her. Learn to vary your voice pitch. This was one thing I had to learn, was to vary my voice pitches and allow myself to throw my voice around, to throw my arms around, to kind of forget about myself and be willing to look dumb, maybe. As a first-year teacher, I sat in Ivan Martin's classroom in Hamlin, Pennsylvania, and my mouth nearly hung open. He was all over the front of his room. He was shooting steel balls at his ninth-grade girls. I was just like, I've learned from him, but I'm not Ivan Martin, and I never will be. The second part of mimic is to put yourself into the culture or historical setting that you're teaching. We've already kind of talked about this. Dress up. Eat their food. Bring food to your class. So you're studying Greece, well, bring them couscous and or gyros or whatever. Maybe avoid the retsina, but you know, adopt the accent with maybe some carefulness. When I think of acting, and it can go too far, but some years ago, my wife and I toured Williamsburg, Virginia, which, if any of you have been there, the place is set up to be as it was in colonial times, and they have a lot of living history reenactors who live and work there. They dress period costumes, but they live it too. While we were there, a quick thunderstorm came up, and we ran for shelter under whatever we could, and there were about half a dozen of us crowded under this tiny little awning in front of one building. The building was locked. We couldn't get into it, so we're all crowded under in there trying to stay dry. One of them was one of the actors. He was actually the town parson, and so he starts asking us, where are we all from? And this one lady says, well, I'm from Kansas. He says, Kansas? Is that out west a ways? True bafflement in his voice. And she says, yeah, we're pretty far out west. Is it out near the Mississippi River, maybe? Says, no, we're beyond the Mississippi River. Really, you must be a ways out west. And it was just, he was not cracking a smile or anything. It was his life. If you can bring that element into your classes, I promise they'll pay attention. Props. This is closely linked to the last one. Costumes, drawings. Okay, here we've got the drawings. Looks like we're not quite done here. Some of them maybe were a little. You're studying geography. You've got the seven countries of Central America they're supposed to memorize. And this is not original with me. At first glance, I thought it seemed a little bit lame or something. And it is sort of, but it sticks. Guatemala has got a lot of people. There are more people in Guatemala than any other Central American country. Belize sounds like bells. The country is almost even shaped like one if you have a good imagination. In Honduras, don't try a Honda race. There's way too many twisting, curving roads. El Salvador means the Savior. Capital San Salvador means Holy Savior. If you're in Nicaragua, you might spend nickels for agua. Costa Rica literally means rich coast. The first explorers came there and they saw this land. Wow, this is amazing. They called it Costa Rica, rich coast. Panama hats aren't even made in Panama, but they might help you remember that. So drawings are helpful. Good literature to read for composition class. You're trying to get your students inspired about writing, so just give them a blank piece of paper and tell them they have 30 minutes. It's not going to happen. Read them some good stories. Mnemonics. And these mnemonics can go from the simple to the profound. Maybe you have a good one you'd like to share. I'll give you a chance just a little bit. You know, you've got how to spell geography. George Elm's old grandmother wrote a pig home yesterday. You've got the Great Lakes. Sarah Maid Henry Olives. You've got the nine planets. Well, now they kicked off Pluto, so now we say my very energetic mother just serves nothing. What are some more things you like to use to help rivet, grab interest? Manipulatives are another good tool. One of the things I bought early on was a set of plastic geometric shapes with removable bottoms. Very helpful. There's this little cube and there's this little pyramid. And when you study the volume of a square pyramid, you know, it's 1/3 length, width, height, you go to the water fountain, you fill that little pyramid and dump it into the cube, and after you do it 3 times, it's full. Oh. I understand Jonah Avina uses bananas to teach fractions. I've never seen his demonstration on that. Some of you may have. I've even heard of teachers using gravel. You know, just something hands-on to show your students. Demonstrations, experiments. The steel ball shooting that I was talking about earlier, it's been too long. It was something to do with physics. And it was this neat little tool thing he had. You'd press a button and the cylinder would shoot out and knock the ball off, and it would actually fly, you know, 4 or 5 feet. You're studying gravity versus inertia. Just get a tennis ball, tie a string around it, and swing it around your head as you explain how the gravity and inertia are working, and then let it go. That was kind of my instead of shooting steel balls, I did that. Any thoughts or questions, comments you'd like to make at this point before we go on to the second side of the handout?
Is it reasonable to ask me like this, like for, you know, that I had sort of obviously teaching you maybe 5 or 6 classes each morning? Can you have a lively introduction for each one? Like,
yeah, it might only be 1 sentence long.
Right.
But you're right. Most of us are very time limited. Some suggestions I've heard that have been helpful are: make 1 good class a day, or choose 1 subject per year and focus on that one. You know, some of this stuff, this inspiration stuff, is something that you should have for all your subjects, including history, Micah, including science. We've argued about this before. But there's also a sense where you've got your specialty, and that's okay. And my students, if you'd ask them how we're early in science classes, but if you ask them about history class, I think they would have a few comments, I hope. So some of that can be okay, and yet you can be enthusiastic about anything. And the longer I taught, the easier I found it to be enthusiastic about even things that at first I had trouble understanding. Did you have a thought on your question there, Micah?
I was going to answer that. It doesn't have to be much.
Right.
You know, just a little bit. You don't have to go extravagant. Just something to get an interest in.
Right. Because here's the thing. If you try to become a Linwood Thompson and dress up for every single history class, it's going to get kind of old hat after a while. You know, variety is the spice of life. So keep things, mix it up a bit. Don't. Okay, ask questions. And ask intelligent questions. Questions that actually make them think. There is a place, there is a need for review questions, just making sure they remember what you've taught. I'm not talking about that. But you're in your class, you're asking questions, make sure they're actually thinking questions. Don't insult, they're intelligent. A thinking person is an involved person. Engagement is key to interest. If you're just back there doing nothing, you're probably not as involved. That's one reason I always have a handout with plenty of blanks. Obviously, it's up to you if you're going to do anything with it, but I'm going to try to do what I can to... Your hand moving keeps your brain engaged. It's something to remember also when you're teaching. If you can get your students to write things down as you teach, it can help keep them with you as well. Have them say things, recite facts, descriptions. The last 2 years in our school, we've used a living history for our lower grade history curriculum, and one thing I really love about that is the way it has all these chants and sayings and things for the students to do and say, motions to make. It really builds that involvement aspect of it. If you're in composition class, ask them questions, get them writing, get them brainstorming. Stop sometimes to ask questions about what you just taught. It helps you know if they're getting it or if they're not getting it. Connect it to their lives. Include your students, their names and their interests in the examples you give, whether it's math problems or making up sentences in language class. Maybe you can mention, okay, so Alexander loved horses. Well, you know there's a boy in your class that loves horses. He was just like you. Whenever my teacher came to the part in the history book where leading up to the Great Depression, the stock market crash of 1929, he had this elaborate example in which he used raising rabbits commercially as an example, because a bunch of his boys raised rabbits, obviously on a very small scale, but you know, if you would expand and you would sell stock, he explained the thing of selling stock, and the rabbits are just producing at an amazing rate and the stock prices go higher and then the rabbits all die and it stuck. Guess what I used when I taught the Great Depression? Use their feelings and emotions. And again, the better you know your students, the better a job you can do this. Connect it to the characters in history class. Involve them. Connect it somehow to them, their interests, what they're doing. Now, sometimes there are these students who have no interest on anything inside the classroom. Well, sometimes they simply need their interest channeled and directed as well.
Tell a story.
Yeah, one thing I'm connecting to their lives there, Verlin. So I did that music class, and my students will know that the half steps are between Brandon and Carson and Eric and Brett. And of those four names, three of them don't care for singing much.
Okay.
But they will remember that.
Right.
And they don't have to remember letters. And it's funny, because you say the first person's name, they know exactly who to say next.
Good. The good thing about telling stories is you can do it in any class. Now, maybe history class lends itself the easiest to it, but if you're struggling in language class, buy the book Eat Shoots and Leaves. There's some things in that book that aren't exactly Christian, but as a discerning teacher with a pen, I think you can deal with that. But there are some examples, and there's some fantastic examples. Stories you can tell about stuff as simple as a semicolon or the structure of our language.
What did you say it was
called? Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. Yeah, based on the old joke of the panda. Walks into it. Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. By Lynn Truss. That's where I got this story about Greece being the leftovers. Actually, I was in encyclopedia. I felt kind of cheap getting it out of an encyclopedia, but hey, there it is. Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was signed by King John in a meadow in Runnymede in 1215. Dry, dull history fact. Well, there's this joke of this very excitable tour guide who would always take these tourists out into this meadow and says, right here in this meadow at Runnymede where King John sat under an oak tree, just like this one over here, and he signed the Magna Carta. He signed it in 1215. And one of the woman tourists looked at her watch and said, it's 1230, we just missed it. And then they remember that date. Did you know that the outcome of the Civil War may very possibly have hinged on the loss of three cigars? And it doesn't always have to be a full-blown story. I found in my study of the Greek language the fact that the Greek word ne is the word for yes. I found that to be terribly fascinating and difficult, so I made sure to weave that in. It feels very strange to say ne. You've heard the fables about George Washington. I can't tell a lie, I cut down the cherry tree. That's what Parson Weems was doing. But do be careful with that. Don't become a second Parson Weems, again, where your students go home talking more about Nikos than Alexander. Make sure it's clear, the line between the anecdote and the fact. Use the board. Draw pictures. Or have your students draw the pictures. Draw diagrams. Make flow charts for your language classes. One thing I did this past year in 7th grade social studies, I had some students who weren't one especially who struggled a bit with reading comprehension. Before class, I would put all the terms up on the board, and then I would define them, and they had to copy them down in their tablet. Sometimes I had them define them. Was it busy work copying exercises? Maybe, but I think they learned some things. Maybe you have a teaching outline that you can put on the board. It's great, great that one thing our students should all learn in school is how to take notes, take an outline. You can demonstrate that by putting your own outline on the board or in a handout. Demonstrate the math problems. Write down the key concepts you're teaching them. Write sample sentences for language class and use your own. The book has them, I know, but use your own. A kind of inside joke with most of my students is the fact that we can hardly get through a class on sentence structure in language without talking about John and his ball. So we study direct objects that John hit the ball. Well, how dry and dull and boring is that? It is. But when the next day you study indirect objects and it's John hit me the ball, and then you have linking verbs, John was not the ball, and intransitive complete verbs, John swung wildly at the ball, and then bring in your objective complements, and after a while, every time I start talking about John and the ball, they're grinning, okay, yep, same thing again. It kind of caught me unawares. I wouldn't have thought that doing something intentionally dull and boring like that could actually create interest, but it did. Use the board a lot. It keep them guessing. Turn to that board often. Now what's he going to write or draw or do? Very, very helpful. The more senses you can engage, the deeper, the better the learning experience will be.
Is it ask for forget on purpose?
I was going to do it last. I'll fill it in now.
Thank you. Let me get the L and I'll come back to it. Thanks for keeping me on my toes, although I missed it on purpose. Link what you're teaching to what is already known. Dropping them into the middle of a history class on Philip is a really bad idea. Now, the good part is your textbooks create a certain flow. And if you use that and you use the review exercises, that's already part of it. But please use this one heavily because it's probably the easiest to use. I would venture to say the most important of all and yet somehow underappreciated. Just review yesterday's lesson. Okay, yesterday we studied Alexander. What do you remember about Alexander?
He was Philip's son.
He was Philip's son. See, I'm using this one here.
Loved horses.
Loved horses.
Caught and trained a wild horse.
Caught and trained a wild horse. What was that horse's name?
Bucephalus.
What I should have actually done was written it on the board so that you'd have a visual for it, because that's a strange term. And so now we've got a perfect link to segue into the new class. Today we're studying about how he conquered Jerusalem. Did you know that Alexander had a dream the night before that there would be a priest in white robes who would come out to meet him? Read Josephus. The story's in there. Use it. Why is reviewing yesterday's lesson so important? Well, it engages their mind. It refreshes the exciting things you taught them yesterday. It imprints those facts more deeply than before and prepares them for what you've got today. The Seven Laws of Teaching by John Milton Gregory is another useful addition to your library, and this is one of his seven laws. Link what you're teaching, this is my own words, but link what you're teaching to what they already know. Nothing is more frustrating to the students than being dropped into a new concept that they have no background on. But the good news is that most of the things we teach, because our textbooks, our curriculums are so well designed anymore, that they do a lot of that interweaving almost seamlessly. What I find fascinating, and it's happened a few times, we'll go through a class, and all of a sudden in the class they realize they know how to do something they didn't know how to do before. They never really caught on when it happened. Because it just, especially in math, that can happen. It just flows so seamlessly. Okay, so I was working on my notes on some things for how to, you know, how do we create impactful openings? I had these ideas, and I was like, well, I should make an acrostic for this. I'm working with my things, you know, to make the letters come out right and all that. And I
didn't have an S, so I said, well, let's make it. But then later I said, no, fill it. Now, there is a time and a place for faking it, perhaps. Like I said, drum up some inspiration. There's a Chinese proverb I want to paraphrase. Assume an inspiration, the original said a cheerfulness, but assume an inspiration you do not feel, and soon you will feel the inspiration you assumed. You're coming to class, you're blank, what do you do? Do something. You know, if nothing else, just, you know, it's math class, just get them up to the board and have them do 3 plus 4. As upper graders, what's he doing now? You know, where's he going with this? We've got a few minutes. Shall we fill this spot on the outline with a problem? Maybe you've got a class that you taught last year that flopped, or something you're dreading this next year, and you'd like some ideas for how to introduce it. We've got just a few minutes here, real quick.
Seems like I've often struggled with when I try to get too dramatic, that kind of thing. Students seem to sense that I am not being sincere or something, and then it kind of seems like, you know, I'm actually roll their eyes. You kind of get that sense a little bit.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on that? How do you, you know, you want to be yourself, but yet you want to put yourself out there and be interesting. How do you find that balance? I don't have any thoughts on that.
I have to hear from some of you others. I find that for me. Okay, I come in here to Teachers Week, and I'm around all these other teachers, and I get excited, and I only have 2 classes all week long, so I can really dedicate myself. I don't have all this stuff going in a normal class. Just the day-in, day-out humdrum keeps, you know, I don't have the time and the energy to act like this all the time. That tones me down. My personality is not naturally this way anyway. Like I said, if you've known me 10 years ago, and then I sit under some others like Jonah Avina, and I'm like, what are some of your thoughts?
One thing to remember is that students don't expect, they do not naturally expect, unless you are a Jonah Avina or something, but I don't think they expect that. And so there is not, we don't have to assume that there is an unconscious demand that we be jumping around every day. It's certainly valid, but we can settle back.
Right. You know, students' need for the interesting and the amazing is partially a created need. If I do this all the time and then I quit, this is going to be a problem. I kind of figured that maybe here with teachers, your need's going to be a little higher. I'm going to have to get a little more dramatic. So I guess, and I should have probably put this in as a caveat, don't try to go home and think you have to have these amazing classes. Just be real, be inspired, and let that come out. Because your students are with you day in and day out, and they learn to know you. And it's really your interest in them and in their lives more than your dramatics that really make the impact.
So is it also true that over-dramatizing is boring, right? Because it's the same thing over and over again. It's still the same thing. What makes the dramatic, to me, what makes them...